Welcome to the Careering into Motherhood podcast. I'm Jane, I run the Careering into Motherhood Facebook group and now host this weekly podcast. My guests have included authors, professors, and anyone who's changing the dialogue around women in the workplace, and especially working mums. My next guest ticks all of those boxes. She really is one of my all-time living heroes, Professor Sue Black. I first heard her talking on Desert Island Discs 2 years ago. I'd set up my own business to help women find jobs, and so I was intrigued by the story of this incredible woman who seemed to have overcome such adversity, this cochineal-haired professor whose music choices included opera as well as gangster rap, and who was so calm and free from any anger, despite having overcome situations that would have broken most people. I was totally awestruck. So when I decided to do a podcast, I thought, I'll chance my luck and send Professor Black an invitation. I almost couldn't believe it when not only did she reply, but she then accepted. So please excuse me if I sound like a teenage fangirl in this interview. You see, her list of achievements reads like a page out of the Guinness Book of Records. Professor Black led the campaign to save Bletchley Park, which many of us will know from the film with Benedict Cumberbatch, The Imitation Game. She began a campaign on social media that ensured it's now a protected historical site and went on to write a best-selling book, Saving Bletchley Park, about her experience. She's Professor of Computer Science and Technology Evangelist at Durham University. In 1998, she set up British Computing Society, which was the UK's first online network for women in tech. She founded Tech Mums, which taught mums tech skills, and more recently, Tech Up Women, which took 100 women with degrees from the North and trained them in specific tech skills. She's a massive advocate for women's empowerment and equality, and was awarded an OBE by the Queen. But she left home at 16 and was a single parent at 25, having left a violent relationship. She took her children and went to a women's refuge with not a single qualification to her name. She put herself through a maths course and went on to university, gained a degree in computing and then a PhD in software engineering. She brought her own family out of poverty through tech education. And somewhere in between all of this, Sue finds the time for her family of four children, four grandchildren, with another on the way soon. It's my absolute honour to have Professor Sue Black as a guest on the podcast today. Sue, I am absolutely delighted to have you on the podcast today. Thank you so much for making the time. I know you're extremely busy. And
you're very welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. So I want to start with talking about your career. You found yourself in a women's refuge with your children. What was it that then led you to think, with everything else going on and a situation that most people would have just been trying to survive, you put yourself through college and maths of all subjects?
Yeah.
What is it in you that drove you to maths?
Well, I always liked maths as a kid. So from when I was five, starting school, I just always loved maths best at school. Yes,
as she says, I'm incredulous.
And, you know, like, for example, when I was about 7 or 8, I used to save my pocket money up so that I could go and buy maths textbooks. So, you know, thinking back, I obviously did really, really like it.
Yeah.
And kind of it was my favourite subject through school, really.
Was it?
But then, like, left school at 16. My mum had died when I was 12 and I wasn't happy at home. So I left as soon as I could, really. So I left home at 16, living in Essex. I moved to London when I was 17, did various jobs, got married at 20. Had my daughter when I was 21, my older daughter, and then I thought, well, I'd been working for RCA Records in a record company in the accounts department doing math, I decided that I would have another baby and then go back to work when I had two kids, but then that turned out to be twin boys.
Oh my God.
So they were born when Emma was just two. At 23, I had three kids under three, so quite a handful.
And did you go back to work?
Well, so my plan was to go back to work, but then unfortunately, when the twins were just about one, so I hadn't really, like, they weren't quite old enough for me to, because in those days they didn't have to keep your job open.
So
I didn't have a job to go back to, so I was going to have to, like, somehow work my way back into the workplace. So I, unfortunately, when the boys were one, my ex-husband kind of lost it basically and threatened all our lives. And so we ran away one morning, and by the afternoon, we're in a women's refuge on the other side of London. Lived there for 6 months, then got a council flat in Brixton, on an estate in Brixton. And then kind of, well, I was like, well, starting life again, I guess, you know, that's not what I'd expected my life to turn out like. And I was on benefits, and I didn't really want to be on benefits. I wanted to try and get back to work. But then I realised, you know, I'd left school at 16 with 5 O-levels. I hadn't worked for 3 years by then. And I kind of realised that I wouldn't earn enough to even pay for childcare for 3 children. So actually going back into work straight away wasn't an option. So then I thought, well, why don't I try and get back into education? I'd ended up leaving school during my A-levels because, you know, I'd left home, and then I was paying rent where I was living at my friend's house. And so just having to work in the evenings and at the weekend, trying to do my A-levels, it just didn't really work out. So I dropped out of school, basically. But I hadn't really wanted to. And so, yeah, so I thought, why don't I try and go back into education? Went along to the local college, Southwark College. Luckily, they had a maths course, which gave you the equivalent of 2 A-levels in 1 year. And it was in the evening, so I could just get a babysitter twice a week, go to my maths classes. And at the end of the year, I had a qualification which enabled me to apply for uni. So I did that, went to Southbank Uni, did a degree in computing, and then carried on, did a PhD in software engineering.
As you do.
Yeah, I know, it sounds crazy, like, thinking back now. And then during my PhD, applied for a lectureship, became a lecturer, so then became an academic, I guess.
Wow. Yeah. And did you, I mean, how did you fit that in? Most people, when I say most people, I'm talking from my own personal experience. Yeah. I have one child and just, you know, managing him plus what I'm trying to do, et cetera, et cetera, is an absolute mind blower. Yeah. So to do all of that and find the energy as well, I'm assuming you studied a lot of, was it at night?
Yeah. So like, particularly at the beginning of my degree, you know, classes, lectures at uni ran from 9 till 6. I had to drop the kids off at 9, get to uni at 10, leave at 2, pick them up at 3:15 at the school gates. So I missed quite a lot of lectures, particularly at the beginning. As they got older, that got easier. So yeah, like, you know, in the evenings, well, I suppose, you know, we didn't have any money, so we had no TV, which was probably a good thing in a way, because when I sat and, like, you know, as the kids got older, did the homework with them. Then they'd go
no
to
Netflix.
Bed. No Netflix. So, and then spent the rest of the night, you know, working on my coursework or reading or whatever I had to do for my kind of uni work.
And did you have a career aim when you were starting out like that? Did you ever think, well, one day I'm going to be professor at Durham University?
No, I really didn't have a clue. I think what I really wanted was to earn enough money to look after 3 kids, you know, like 4 of us. And, you know, we were definitely living in poverty for several years, really, mainly like when I was an undergraduate, because, you know, even though I got a grant, which was great and enabled me to go to uni, I had to pay my rent out of that, just, you know, all the bills and everything. So I was, in fact, better off on benefits than I was on a student grant.
Really?
So the time that I was uni, I was extremely poor. And and at times didn't have enough money to buy shoes for the kids or even buy food sometimes. So I think that's definitely affected my the way that I guess I live my life. And I think some of the difficult things that have happened to me earlier on have, I think, enabled me in some way to kind of just keep going, because as I'm kind of going through my life, I've been going through my life, it's always been better just about than those things, those situations I've been stuck in. It's been better than that. And so I guess I've just kind of wanted to keep on going. And definitely early on, I was really focused on earning enough money so I wouldn't have to worry about paying the bills, because that's just such a heavy mental load to have. You know, like, I nearly got taken to court for not paying the rent. And, you know, just worrying about, can you buy shoes for your kids? Can you pay the electricity bill? Having those kind of worries kind of day in, day out for months, years, like, really affects your ability to just be successful and live a happy life, I think. You know, it just kind of weighs over you all the time. So my real aim was to get out of that situation.
And did you, it almost sounds a stupid question now, but did you have any role models that you looked up to? Was it, I mean, because everything you talk about, you are, it's such an overused word, but you really are a trailblazer and doing stuff that other people haven't done before you, and, you know, people will look at you as a role model. Did you have any
role models? Well, I think, because I get asked this quite often.
Oh, do you?
I know, and it's quite hard to, not that's the, but it's a good question. I'm not saying it's a bad question. And all I can think of really was at the time, like when we had had a TV, I used to watch Oprah.
Yeah.
So she was a great role model for me. And around that time again, I used to read books by like Maya Angelou. And so women who've come from very, very difficult circumstances and managed to make something of themselves, to have successful lives. So thinking back, they're the two main people that I think of, really.
Yeah, I can see it. Now you say that. And also, you went into not only academia, which is very male-dominated, but then STEM and maths.
Yeah.
How did you navigate that? You were doing this 10, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Do you think you had any specific skills, or did you just get on with it?
Well, I think like during my degree, it was about 10% women, 90% guys. But to be honest, I don't even remember noticing that at all. I kind of didn't really grow up thinking men do this, women do that, or anything, or put any restrictions on myself in terms of men's roles or women's roles. I just thought I love maths. That's, you know, like, so I'll do a maths course. And then I thought maths or computing. I got very excited about technology and thought technology was the future. Mm. And I still believe that.
Yeah.
And also I presumed, which is probably not true, but I presumed at the time that I'd earn more money if I got a degree in computing than one in maths.
Right.
But that's probably not true at all. But that's what I thought. And so that's, you know, that's why I studied computing and not maths at university, those two things together. And yeah, so during my undergraduate degree, I don't think I really thought about men, women, anything. Mm. And it wasn't really till I went on and did my PhD when I had to network at conferences. And I hadn't thought about the male, female thing. And I just found the first few conferences I went to, I had some not so great experiences just trying to chat to men about my research. And of course, some men are great, but you don't need the odd one who's just a bit strange. And you can totally lose your confidence. I thought to myself, why am I no good at talking to people at conferences? Yeah. I thought it was me.
Yeah, yeah.
And it wasn't until maybe a year or two after the first time I'd done that, that I went to a Women in STEM conference in Brussels.
Mm.
And I remember walking in thinking, oh no, you know, like I'm not very good at this. I'm not good at talking to people. And walked in, went to the registration desk, got my badge, went to get a cup of tea. And somehow then completely forgot about all of that because it seemed like everyone was talking to everyone else.
Mm.
So those barriers just weren't there.
Mm.
And I came back. I mean, that conference changed my life, really, because it really showed me that now and again, it's amazing to be in an all-women environment.
Yes.
And I wouldn't want that all the time. I still love working in tech if it's 80-20 men and women. I'm as happy in a sort of male-dominated environment as a female-dominated environment, and I prefer a mixed environment, really, to be honest. But you know that wasn't kind of an issue. But what I realised was that being if you're in the majority, life is just easier. And so being at an all-women conference, I was in the majority. So there were just barriers that had been there at conferences that weren't there.
Yes.
And also, I just made so many great friends, to be honest, and came back thinking I've got to try and set something up in the UK which gives me that same feeling, which helps other women connect to me and to other women working in tech, studying tech, so that we've got a place where we can just chat about stuff to do with technology, to do with ourselves, just being women. And so came back and set up BCS Women, the British Computer Society's Women's Network, which was in 1998, so I can't believe it's 22 years ago now. But that was the UK's first online network for women in tech and still going strong.
But you didn't stop there.
No.
Let's give the full list.
Yeah.
So you do so much philanthropy and especially promoting equality and supporting people in the minorities.
Yeah.
Obviously, you went on and set up Tech Mums.
Yeah.
You talk about it. I won't paraphrase what it is. It's your business.
Yeah, so Tech Mums is all about teaching mums digital skills, technology, helping improve confidence in tech, because I really feel like technology and education have just so dramatically changed my life and my life chances. And, you know, and because of that, my children, I've now got four children and four grandchildren, and so changed their life chances as well. And, you know, I kind of want that experience to happen for everybody.
Yeah.
And about 8 or 9 years ago, I heard, I mean, there were various things that kind of brought Tech Mums about, but one was I'd had a career in computing by then and still loved it and wanted everyone to get excited about technology. I just saw so much opportunity. But so often in the press, it was negative stuff about, I don't know, robots are killing us or taking our jobs away.
Yeah.
All of that. But and so, you know, well, I don't know about robots killing us, but, you know, there are negative sides to everything.
Yeah.
But what about the positive side? That wasn't there at all. And so I thought I need to try and do something about that. And I started running coding and app design workshops with seven-year-olds. So and at the same time, Michael Gove, who was the education secretary, was saying that computing's too difficult for anyone under 14. And I just thought, that's a load of rubbish. That is such a load of rubbish. I've got to prove that's not true. So, and there wasn't computing or coding in schools really then. So I ran some workshops with seven-year-old kids teaching app design, coding, and which went amazingly well. And then we'd get the parents in at the end of the day to have a go at what their kids have been doing. And when I asked the parents to have a go, so not everyone, but in general, the dads would just be, okay, what do you want me to do? You could just
really?
See them kind of step in and look at the computer. And, you know, some of the mums would be the same, but then some would be like, have a bit of a look of horror on their faces, like, oh, you know, what are you asking me to do? And just in that moment, I just started thinking, well, why don't I, you know, like run some courses for mums in tech, because if we can show mums what opportunities are out there in technology, we can empower them and build their confidence with technology. But then also, of course, that's going to affect the kids as well. And I don't know what the percentages of, you know, who's the main, who has the main caring responsibility for kids, but I'm sure it's more than 50% mums. So if we can change the way that mums see tech and feel empowered with tech, then of course we change the kids as well. So we might target one person, but we get to many, and then those kids grow up being encouraged to do stuff in tech, but also, you know, with the mums understanding how to stay safe online, that kind of stuff, you know, and the mums feeling more empowered to maybe set up their own business online, to go back and study computing in some way. So I just saw focusing on mums as an ideal thing for me to do. So I put together a program and 7 years ago started running that in a school in Tower Hamlets, Bishop Challoner School. And, you know, and it's still running in various different places. We've got three libraries in Leeds running Tech Mums at the moment and some groups in Cardiff. And so we've kind of, we've worked all around the country with different organisations, mainly schools and libraries and colleges. And we just last year brought in a CEO, Lauren, who's amazing and who's working to scale up Tech Mums, take it across the UK and then across the world. You know, we've got various countries talking to us about working with
us. Fantastic. And, but there's one and there's more. We just talked about Tech Up Women, which I think is working in more in the north of the UK.
So I got a job 15 months ago at Durham University. So I live in London but work in Durham, so I'm in both places.
Nice commute.
It's really good fun. I feel like the train up north is my office.
So
that's been amazing. Well, the first week that I was there, I'm a professor of computer science there. The first week that I was there with my colleagues, another female professor, Alexandra Christia, and Julie Swinbank, who works there, we worked together to put together a proposal to apply to the Institute of Coding for funding to run a program to retrain women with degrees, particularly from underrepresented backgrounds and specifically in the North and the Midlands, to retrain those women into tech careers. Because throughout my career now, loads of people say, you know, from different companies, we want to hire technical women, but we can't find any. You know, like we advertise our jobs, no women apply, or women apply and they don't get through the process. What can we do? And, you know, there's no one simple answer to that. But one thing that I've always thought would be a good idea was there's so many women out there with potential, just ridiculous amounts of women with potential that can't achieve that potential. Loads of those women want to work in tech, but maybe have got a degree in a different background, you know, maybe worked in a different profession and want to retrain into tech, or maybe their skills are not up to date and they want to go back into tech. So I thought, why don't we bring together some partners and put together a program which retrains those women into tech careers? So we put together 17 industry partners, four universities.
So you've got the support of industry as well behind it.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
And created a course which took 100 women through a program which just finished last month, training those women into tech careers. And working with industry really helped, because we asked the companies we worked with, what sort of job roles do you want to fill? You know, where do you want to recruit women into?
Yeah.
And they said specifically, so we had kind of like a short list, but the top four were software developer, agile project manager, business analyst, and data scientist. And so we created a program between us. So the academic and industry partners together created a program which took 100 women through basics of computer science through to those four job roles. And they could choose kind of, it was kind of in three terms. And so the last term they could choose which job role they wanted, and then they trained specifically into that job role. Most of the PALs had a qualification which went along with it, so I did the qualification, and now most of 100 women are interviewing with those companies.
That's
and
incredible.
Other companies for jobs, and some women along have got jobs along the way, so they didn't even need to get to the end and interview with those partners. They'd already found a job as they were on the program. And we really focused hard, particularly at the beginning, on building confidence and getting everyone bonding with each other. And it's just been one of the most incredible 6 months of my life, really. Just 100 amazing women. Well, 96% retention.
That's incredible.
And just all of those women are going to go on and do amazing things. They're already doing amazing things. It's just been amazing.
Yeah. And the other thing, they're obviously going to go and tell all of their networks as well, which will hopefully drive even more demand.
Incredible. No, absolutely. So currently I'm now focused on bringing funding in so we can run it again. So if anyone's got £500,000, please let me know.
Talking of which, I mean, the thing that strikes me when you talk about all of these things you do, you just spot a problem and you go out. And that's it, I'm going to solve it.
I just love solving problems. It's what kind of makes me
sick,
I think.
being a mathematician. And something similar around Bletchley Park, which I'd love to talk about how, you know, you built an entire movement driven by social media, didn't you?
So I think I first went up there representing BCS Women in 2003. At that time, found out that 8,000 women worked there, but there wasn't anything about that online that I could find. Wanted to promote the fact that like 80% of the people that worked there were women. So got an oral history campaign, oral history project funded, and interviewed 15 of the women that worked there. Then at the launch of that, found out that Bletchley Park might have to close, that the work that was done there was said to have shortened World War II by 2 years, and 11 million people a year were dying. So potentially saved 22 million lives and it might close. And I just thought, I've got to do something about it. So by then, that was 2008, I was head of department at the University of Westminster. And so I was on an email list for all the heads and profs in the country of computing. Emailed all of them, said we've got to do something about this. Then managed to get myself on BBC News Today programme. And then all of us as heads and profs wrote a letter which went in the Times. So that was, July 2008. So that kind of was on the BBC front page.
And you got Stephen
Fry. And got lots
Fry,
of lots of emails then, as some code breakers got in touch, which
really
was amazing. But then it all kind of quietened down and I didn't know what else to do. And so it was the end of 2008, I started using Twitter in earnest, and got various people involved. I set up a blog kind of telling the story of what we were doing. And then February 2009, I saw Stephen Fry, he tweeted a selfie saying he was stuck in a lift in Centre Point in London. And I just thought, Stephen Fry, he must be interested in Bletchley Park. He loves technology, he loves history. So I checked on Twitter. Luckily, he was following me, so I could send him direct messages, private messages. Sent him several messages that evening, you know, but I was telling everybody, you know, but fingers crossed. And then the next morning, he tweeted a link to my blog, and I was getting 50 hits a day, and that day I got 8,000.
Oh my God.
And became the most retweeted person in the world on Twitter.
Really?
Yeah, that day, which is, completely crazy.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, just the power of social media for good as well.
Absolutely. And so, my book, Saving Bletchley Park, which I wrote after.
Yes.
One of the main reasons I wrote that was to promote Bletchley Park again and the women's contribution and everything that happened there, but also to promote social media as a tool for good. Because a lot of the time people, I think, just think it's bad. And of course, again, bad things happen. But, you know, we couldn't have saved Bletchley Park without Twitter. We just could not have reached all of those people. Because it was just that kind of one thought that I had quite early on, which was, if I just type Bletchley Park into the search box in Twitter, I can search everyone in the world that's already talking about Bletchley Park. And I can connect to them and get them involved in the campaign and then ask them to connect, you know, to bring their friends in. And I just did that every day for 3 years. plus, and then loads of people got involved. You know, someone ran a comedy fundraiser. Someone else walked up to Everest Base Camp. You know, my idea was to, you know, encourage other people to do their own thing,
yes.
contribute whatever they could. And then kind of after 3 years, Bletchley Park got 4.1 million from Heritage Lottery Fund.
Incredible.
And also I brought Google in to talk to Bletchley Park as well, and they helped out too. So
Did they? What did Google do? Oh, because of the relation with coding? And
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's a really strong relationship between the two. But actually that came about because of some of Alan Turing's papers being up for auction, I think in 2010. And I asked Google if they would contribute to that, and they came in and helped out with that.
Amazing.
And then kind of helped to build the relationship up from then.
Yeah,
really.
I just can't get over, as I say, as you're talking, you know, I just got Google in. Oh, I just got Stephen Fry. Oh, I just wrote another book. And I mean, the theme through everything in your life just seems to be resilience. I mean, obviously determination, but resilience. And how do you cope, I suppose? How do you manage your time and do you find any time for yourself?
Yeah, completely. I mean, the thing is, one thing I've learned as I get older is if I don't find time for myself, I just start running out of energy.
Mm.
So I really think that's one of the biggest learnings of getting older. Mm. That makes me sound really old, but you know what I mean?
You're the youngest, coolest looking grandma I've ever met.
Thank you. But you know, when I was younger, I just used to put so much pressure on myself to keep going. And then at some point I'd just get ill and I'd have to spend 3 days in bed with terrible flu or something because I just couldn't keep going. And it's probably my body's way of saying it's too much.
Yeah.
Whereas now, you know, I kind of build time in, you know, and I don't work weekends anymore.
Really?
So I used to work all through weekends and everything. I don't do that anymore, unless, I mean, occasionally I have to. But in general, I don't work weekends at all. Don't even look at work or even think about it. And take time out, you know. And if I was just talking to a friend yesterday at work about this kind of thing, saying that, because she was saying something like, don't you ever get worn out?
Yeah.
And I was saying, well, yeah, I do. But kind of when I notice now that I'm starting to either feel just really fed up with everything, or just ridiculously tired. It still takes me a little while, so maybe 2 or 3 hours. But then at some point I think, okay, so this, I know when this happens, it means I need a break. Mm. And so I was just saying to her, in October, so I was going up to Durham every week from London, teaching there. And then twice in October, as well as that, I went over to the States to 2 different conferences to take our students over to the States. So I'd just been traveling a lot, doing loads of stuff. It was really good fun. But then I was on the train home from Durham, back to London one evening, and I was just sitting there thinking, God, I really feel shit. What is wrong? What's going wrong? You know, just why am I feeling like this? And then sort of gradually over that three-hour journey down to London, I thought, oh, no, I'm just completely
exhausted.
Worn out.
Exhausted.
Yeah, and so I just need to build in some time. And so then I just look in my diary for when's the first day that I can completely take off.
And 5 years' time.
Well, and the thing is, if it's not during the week, I don't work at the weekends right now. Mm. And so I've got a lovely husband who's very supportive and my youngest daughter's still at home. So I just tell them I'm just going to sit in my pyjamas all day today and watch rubbish on telly or, you know, Netflix.
Even Professor Sue Black sits in her pyjamas and watches TV.
Well,
quite
often. Well, not too often, obviously. But so if I can't do it during the week, I'll do it at the weekend. And I just don't get dressed. I sit there. I love knitting and crocheting.
Do you?
Yeah, so I make clothes for my grandchildren. Oh, I just sit there watching, you know, whatever series I'm looking at or some comedy or something.
Mm.
Just so that I completely have a rest for 24 hours, and normally I'm fine after that.
And what is it? I know you're in your title at Durham is technology evangelist. Don't you ever just feel like, I've done my bit now, let's pass this over to somebody else?
No. I just feel like there's so many more things I want to do.
Amazing.
So many. And the thing is, I get so much great feedback to me, you know, like, so just now, the 6 months running Tech Up Women, meeting 100 incredible women and seeing them just completely blossom and become more confident and just, you know, connect with each other, come up with ideas for projects that they're going to do, get jobs, you know, like get to know them. Like two of our, well, one of our women had a baby during, Edna had a
really?
Baby during, yeah, during the 6 months. And then, So, you know, seeing them with their kids yeah. and their families. And it's just so life affirming. And it's so wonderful to know that, you know, like 15 months ago, I had an idea.
Mm.
And here we are at the end of it. We got it funded. We ran it. And we've changed, you know, and not only the participants, but like all of us running it, we all had an amazing time as well. And, you know, I feel like we'll all be friends forever, all of us. So like 115 or 20 or whatever it is. And we've all come away from it just feeling inspired by each other. And like, how could I? You couldn't pay for that at all.
No.
You couldn't get that. So to know that that was an idea in my head that that loads of people helped me to make happen.
Yes.
It's just, you know, that's the sort of thing that just if I feel down at all, I can think about that and just feel extremely happy.
Yeah. Oh, amazing. Absolutely incredible. I could talk for hours, but I've got three final questions for you, which I ask all interviewees, all my guests, three questions at the end of each episode.
Yeah.
The first one is, what's been the impact of having children on your career?
Well, I think early on, so I think if I'd been in a sort of situation of being on my own and living in poverty without my kids, I might have given up, you
really?
Know, so I think they really kept me going. Mm. And I think going into my career, I felt like I was doing it for them because I was so desperate for them to have a life where, you know, I wasn't always scrimping and saving to try and find enough food. Mm. You know, I didn't want them to have that kind of life. And so it really at the beginning, they gave me the inspiration to kickstart my career, I guess, to go back into education. And, you know, and they, you know, they just give me so much joy now that I've got four grandchildren as well and one due in a couple of weeks. It's just such a joy being a grandmother. I mean, all the cliches are true.
Really?
You know, like, yeah, because, you know, I don't have to get up in the night.
Yep.
Well, occasionally, you know, but I don't really have to get up in the night.
Yeah.
But there's, you know, these four gorgeous little kids that I just want to hang out with all the time, really. It's just so wonderful.
Mm.
Oh, and of course, my kids are great too. So.
And what's the one piece of career advice you would give to your younger self?
Only one.
Well, generally.
I guess trust your gut instincts.
Really?
Yeah, I really feel like, you know, my generation were brought up to listen to our sort of elders and betters.
Mm.
And I think you should do that. But at the same time, you're the only person that knows you really well. You're the person that knows you the best. So talk to people for advice, but then do what in your gut tells you is the right thing to do. And I wish I'd felt more confidence in myself to be able to do that when I was younger.
Mm. That's brilliant advice. It really is. And finally, how can people find out more about you and your work?
I love being on Twitter.
Of course, yes.
So I'm at Dr. Black on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
So come and chat to me there. I'm very happy to chat to people. I'm kind of all over the internet. So
yes,
if you just
Google
me, you'll be able to find me.
And your book, obviously, Saving Bletchley Park.
Yeah, Saving Bletchley Park.
It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today. Thank you so much.
No, thanks so much for inviting me.
What an incredible episode. I feel so honoured to have had Professor Black, Sue, as she likes to be called, on the show today. I mean, just her resilience and the speed with which she works. And if there was ever a human proof that you can overcome adversity and turn your hands to pretty much anything and make it a success with focus and determination, that's Sue. I'm so grateful to her, and I really hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. Please don't forget to like, subscribe, and leave a review for the podcast.